This evening I would like to discuss a topic that in many ways we've discussed before, but never perhaps from the focus that we need to. And the subject is prophecy, but an evaluation of the issue of doubts about prophecy. Now, there is a general point of view that the Church has explained over many years, and there are new ideas that do come from time to time, not about any particular prophecy, but about the question of whether it's a prophecy at all, or whether it's already been fulfilled, or whether it really is history and not prophecy. And of course, people want to know, well, how do I know that it has any relevance today? We have, of course, the general summation given years ago in an article about seven keys to studying and understanding the Bible, that there is often duality, which doesn't mean it can't be repeated even more than twice, in many things that are in the biblical account. But there is a question that is being posed today in the minds of many, as a result, of course, of the interest in the world around us in prophecy and the defense mechanisms in many of the established in theology who are unable to give answers to those in the world who have questions about prophecy. And so there is an issue that is being raised in the world, and from time to time it comes among some of us. And that is what I read in the Bible written by a prophet a prophecy, or is it history? And if it's history, why do we call it a prophecy? And how are we going to understand it anyway? What are the methods by which we would explain that an event that has happened really is also a prophecy? So we need to take a look at this question, because it is an issue that is fundamental to your ability as an individual to understand vast sections of the Bible. Now, I'm going to use this evening the Jewish translation for a reason. The reason is the way the Bible is organized. I have the King James also here. It has nothing to do with any one form of expression here or there. We're not dealing with the technicalities in a prophecy. We're going to look this evening at the question of what is prophecy and how do we know when it is. And suppose a prophet like Isaiah spoke of an event and it happened. Is it all over? Do we close the book and go to some other place? This is the question we need to look at, because it is often argued, but that's already been fulfilled. Or, but that never happened like the prophet said it would, so that's just one of those things that failed. Most of you, of course, in reading the King James Version, read it as a librarian saw the books of the Bible in Egypt. You see, when the books of the Bible, as we basically know it in the Western world, were originally organized in the form in which we have them now, in the Old Testament I'm speaking of, from Genesis to Malachi, they were organized in terms of the concept of a librarian. Now, I appreciate librarians. I have never discerned the logic of the organization in libraries, and I am sure that librarians use what is found in a card catalog on the basis of the fact that at least they can follow, you know, the numbers and the letters, and that becomes a solution. Now, whether there is any way of organizing the mass of knowledge, I don't propose any better solution than what the Library of Congress has and what we have to use. But nevertheless, the fact remains that as the King James Version came down to us through the Latin, through the Septuagint, via the influence of the librarians in Alexandria, Egypt, where they wanted to put the books of the Bible that were once in Hebrew on separate scrolls in logical order, they decided that there was no problem with the five books of the law. They decided that we go from there to Joshua and Judges, and they tucked Ruth in, and then they had Samuel and Kings, and by the time you finished that, they thought you ought to have all the rest like it, so they pushed Chronicles right after Kings, which starts with Adam again, right in the middle of the Old Testament. And then they proceeded with a number of other books of various sorts, called just writings in general. It might have been philosophy, poetry. And then they got to what they thought were the prophets, and they had those, basically, as we have it. But after Jeremiah, they tucked in Lamentations. So the organization is, as you might think of, well, we want to look at what is history, and we want to look at what is prophecy, we want to look at what is philosophy, we'll look at what is law, we'll look at what is poetry, and when we don't know what to do with a book, we'll tuck it in next to the author of some other book. Same author in this case. Now, that's not the way the Bible was originally organized. That's not the way we have it as the Old Testament was given to the living church. The God rules through the prophets and through the judges and through the priests. And most of the problems that have arisen in the very question of what constitutes prophecy and is it history and did it happen? If so, why do we think it's going to happen again or how will it happen again? All those questions arise because we have gotten away from the order in which the books were given to the only church that originally had them. And I think we better get back to some basics. There is a law. There are prophets and there are writings, said Jesus. Sometimes all the Old Testament is referred to as the law because, point one, it's all based on law. And you might think of it, since the law heads the three areas, that could give its name to the whole. So sometimes the word law is used when any area of the Old Testament is being quoted. But sometimes it is in terms of law and prophets. In terms of the character of the Bible and in terms of who were used to write it. And then we have, of course, the law, the prophets, and the writings, which express the organized, threefold division of the Old Testament as it was on the scroll. What I want to draw attention to you tonight first is what constitutes the prophet. So I would like to turn to the section that is called the prophet. This is the Bible Jesus had. This is the Bible with which he took no exception. This is the Bible that would help us understand the prophets and the prophecies if we would see it. Now, logically, the last of the prophets is Malachi, and there's no difference in the organization of the last 12 books. But you will notice that in the Hebrew, the last really separate book in the prophets is not actually Malachi itself, but called the 12. In other words, the book, or the long scroll that closed the Old Testament, was in fact in sections. 12 separate, if you please, booklets on a scroll, or prophets who made up an entire book comparable to the one that precedes it, Ezekiel, and then there's one before it, Jeremiah, and then there's one before it, Isaiah. So the prophets end with Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12. Now, there's no difference in organization in the order in which they appear, but it is significant that you're asked to look at the 12 as a unit, not as separate books alone. That should help you understand why you start out with Hosea, and when you get to Joel or Amos or Obadiah, now you can begin to see the logic of why different men said what they did and why they are in the order in which they are, why it doesn't start out with Haggai or Zephaniah or Zechariah, or if you please, Habakkuk. Why doesn't the section start out with Jonah? Well, there are reasons. Because when you see the order in which these books are given and preserved in the King James Version, you should see them not as separate volumes that are alphabetized, which they're not. Hence, Zechariah precedes Malachi. You see it rather in terms of a whole book with divisions in which each prophet makes a contribution. But you might think that Isaiah begins the prophet. No. Isaiah is, in fact, in terms of the major divisions, in the last half, you note prior to Isaiah is 2 Kings, then 1 Kings, and 2 Samuel, and 1 Samuel, and Judges, and Joshua. Now, most people start the prophets with Isaiah. They left Joshua, Judges, and Samuel, and Kings, and Chronicles all as history. And this is the source of the error. They have not noted that as far as God is concerned, and the church that was used to convey the mind of God in this matter, Isaiah does not begin the prophet. Joshua begins the prophet. Now, the function of a prophet is to convey something for the future. So, Joshua may be writing history, but his primary function in terms of why the book is written for us, I didn't say why Joshua wrote the book, but why the book is written for us, is that he plays the role of a prophet. Then, he was a general. He was a leader and a judge in the nation. Whether any of these men had the full grasp of why they were writing is not relevant to the question. Daniel himself, we know, didn't, and Daniel is not among the prophets because the kind of book he wrote didn't fit the organization of the prophets. Which brings up a question that I will touch on immediately and then get away from. Abraham is a prophet, but he appears in the law. Daniel is a prophet, but he appears in the writing. In other words, prophets may have contributed, as Daniel, and for that matter as Moses, to other parts of the Bible. But the other parts of the Bible are not organized to be specifically viewed in terms of prophecy itself. I will take the difference between Chronicles and Kings. The reason Chronicles is not one of the prophets, whereas Kings is, and you should know where these books are in the Bible, I presume you are at least that literate, and I don't have to explain where. You see, Chronicles starts out with a genealogy, and it goes from Adam to Noah, and it goes from Noah to the three sons, and their families, and then it takes the family of Israel down through, especially Levi and Judah, all the way to the Persian period. And that's not prophecy. And then there is a large area devoted to organization of the priesthood, the function at the temple. That was not meant to be prophecy. But it doesn't exclude the possibility of parallel events in Chronicles with Kings that have prophetic significance. It doesn't exclude the possibility of certain books, such as Daniel, being important as a prophecy, any more than it excludes statements in Deuteronomy about the coming of the Messiah. But the rest of the book does not play an organized role in the way the prophets are organized to tell us a story. They must be seen in terms, as Daniel, of its relationship to events of the period in which he was living, and it is tied to Ezra and Nehemiah because a number of the prophecies in Daniel are linked up very closely with historic events at that period. So there may be prophets outside, that is, in the area of the writings, like David was a prophet. Many of the Psalms are prophets, and that's why Jesus, in a sense, when he said the law and the prophets, was including a lot of the prophecies that would be found in the writings, as in Psalms. But the fact remains, the Psalms represent a kind of book totally different from these that I have just looked at, called the prophets, that they belong in an area of writings that may or may not be prophets. So what we're going to examine is the nature of these books that are called the prophets, so that we can understand the issues that are besetting some individuals. Let us note then first Joshua. We'll take a look at a book. Now, we're not going to go through all the books chapter by chapter or verse by verse. We're just going to take a note that Joshua is normally thought of as historic in the record of events. And without doubt, Joshua, when he gives an account,
is in fact writing from the point of view of conveying what has happened in the period over which he has had charge. Now the question is then, what relevance does this have in terms of the future? Well, we note that there are indeed two different kinds of books in the prophets. Those that are essentially a record of events that happened year by year in the life of a judge or some individual. Now, the situation in Joshua should be very simple. Joshua essentially is a writer. I will interrupt a moment here and mention that a white Rambler wagon on Green Street has the lights on, 346-G-O-N. Rambler wagon, 346-G-O-N, Green Street. Thank you. Joshua is a writer of events of his time. What is the meaning, then, for us, is the question we should logically ask if we discover Joshua is a prophet. The answer is Joshua is devoting most of the book to the period of time pertaining to the conquest of the land of Canaan. Now, Joshua and Judges and Samuels and Kings, those two books, in a sense are basically historic in framework, whereas Isaiah through the 12 tend to have messages that may or may not have had any historic immediate relevance to the time of the prophet. So what we find in Joshua is a very important view of history. That is the conquest or the occupation of a territory. Now, God knows that there's going to be a great future in terms of the history of the children of Israel. And the occupation of the land of Canaan then becomes not only a historic record of what happened and how it happened, but a revelation that anybody who does the same things that the children of Israel did will reap whatever good comes from obedience to God and whatever consequences come from disobedience. There would come a time, in other words, that the children of Israel, as we know in history, were driven out of the land of Canaan and have disappeared as a whole from view except remnants of the house of Judah. We will not now discuss why we draw the conclusion, you should have examined that yourselves, that the house of Israel as a whole has spread around the world and has become the dominant group in the last century. In the English-speaking, and the French-speaking, and the Dutch-speaking, and the Belgian-speaking, and the Scandinavian-speaking areas of the world. Joshua is a prophecy because it says that if we do, as Joshua was commanded, we'll resolve many of the national problems that exist. If we were to occupy a land. Joshua, in other words, is a book that is given as guidance to the children of Israel, whether they knew it or not, so that when they came to the New World, when they came to the South Pacific, when they came to southern parts of Africa, if indeed they had realized why they were there and who should have led them, they should have done it as Joshua did. And now we find problems because people of diverse characteristics, diverse approaches to life, to philosophy, to religion, to politics, are living side by side. The question is not at this moment, and I will not discuss it, what rights the children of Israel as they migrated around might have had, how they knew or might have known what was the land that God had reserved for them. The answer is they didn't. They thought it might be. They looked upon this world as where the United States is, as New Canaan. Now, this is certainly common in the early literature of New England. But how they dealt with the Indians of the New World was not as Joshua would have required under God if this nation was not to have future problems. This is true for any nation. This is why when you have two people living in Israel, the Arab and the Jew, why when you have two religions in Lebanon, Christian and Muslim, why when you have two people in Turkey, the Armenian and the Turk, the Christian and the Islamic people, why when you have two people in India, the Islamic, and there are many others, but basically the Hindu, you will not have peace. There will be no peace between India and Pakistan. There will be no peace in Rhodesia or South Africa. There will be no peace in Lebanon in the long run. And there will certainly be none in Israel. Because when you have the diversity that you have in those areas, you have the consequences that we will note when we come to the book of Judges. In other words, you can go through Joshua, and now you can review the history of the United States and Canada, South Africa and Rhodesia. If you please, all the rest of the colonies in Africa, the Caribbean, Australia and New Zealand, and India. And you will discover the cause of the problems that exist. It's just a fact. Joshua tells us many stories of the experiences of the nation. Now, this was a carnal nation, but carnal nations are all we have on earth. And if a carnal nation is going to survive, a carnal nation cannot survive on any other basis than the command that God gave to the children of Israel through Joshua, since they were going to do it themselves instead of letting God do it with hornets and bees. And that would have been a lot simpler than swords. But the children of Israel decided to do these things in their own strength instead of in God's strength. But in any case, no nation that compromises its rights with other nations is ever going to live without internal problems. Those that I have mentioned are illustrations. The children of Israel did compromise. Their religion changed as a result. Now, sometimes in the book of Joshua, there isn't any doubt we have specific events. Let us say the fall of Jericho would be classed as it is written in the form of history. We will not argue with the historians or the archaeologists as to whether it happened. It is at least not written as a prophecy, as a message. It's written as if it were an event. But if you note carefully the nature of this event, as I have often gone through it in the days of unleavened bread, it is significant that the events surrounding the fall of Jericho become parallel with what's going to happen to this world, of which Jericho was a type. It happened on the days of unleavened bread, the 7 days Jericho was surrounded. This is a statement of a priest in the New Testament period, Josephus. And there's no reason to think otherwise because it immediately follows the celebration of the Passover. And the putting out of sin during the days of unleavened bread is paralleled ultimately by the destruction of the city of Jericho. And it fell on the 7th day of unleavened bread. And in fact, that year it was also the Saturday of the Roman week, because the Passover that year was a Saturday of the Roman week. And therefore, it is typical of what is going to be done in the millennium. But prophecies are not always clear and direct. They are left to us to discern. And so there may be events that have general meaning in Joshua and events that have specific meaning. And you are to read this book in terms of its historic worth. On the one hand, the general meaning it has for the foundation of any nation. And the reason, of course, the prophets start with Joshua is that he starts with the foundation of a nation in the land. If we want to know whether we're going to have problems in this country, we want to know whether we founded it as God intended Joshua to, or whether we proceeded to do what we have now in the book of Judges, where every man began to do what is right in his own eyes. And now we move to Judges quickly to see what is here. Again, cast in the form of historic events over a period of some 350 years. It's the story of how the children of Israel conducted themselves with their neighbors. What they did with people that were in their midst. How they compromised on religion. Why, in other words, do we have today not the religion that God gave the children of Israel, but why we have instead what is called Protestantism and Catholicism and Buddhism and Islam or the black Muslims and all of the other so-called near-Christian sects like the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons and the Christian Scientists as the world defines them. And I'm not in this sense, well, as any group. I'm not defining them one way or another except as the world looks at these groups, there are major differences. How is it that all these things exist in this country? Well, they exist for the same reason that in the book of Judges, we have historic events that tell us that when you allow things to happen in the nation, the religion and the philosophy and the approach or way of life of that nation will change. If you get away from those things which are fundamental, this can happen in Christianity as it did. It can happen in the Church of God today as it did once before. The more we let the ship go adrift, and one of the areas of drift is this very area of prophecy that I am discussing tonight, where people are not sure what they're reading in the prophets. And what the meaning is. The book of Judges is a series of events in the past whose meaning is important enough that God proposed that these historic events should be viewed not only for what happened, on the one hand, but should be viewed in terms of the consequences as we would see whether there are parallels today that fit them. And when the children of Israel did that which was right, these are the consequences. When they did what was wrong, these are the consequences. And so we look at the consequences and we can say today, what we see therefore is that if we do that, these are the things we'll reap. When we begin to allow, as it did happen, the Hessians to bring in the Christmas tree, we will soon have Christmas in the United States as an illustration. Whether that's important or not is not an issue. It just happens to be an illustration of the fact that Christmas was not one of the original customs practiced by many of the earlier settlers of the United States in the northern tier of colonies. But there came a time where, I should say when, as a result of the hired soldiers of the Gentiles that the British brought over and that brought their ideas over here, this custom began to take root in this country. And we can go throughout history and find the same thing. Judges is a story of political events, judicial events, or religious events in which people do what they think is right. Sometimes it's right. But there is a cardinal rule of thumb that you would not have to go to the stock market for. It's in the book of Judges. The majority is always wrong. The book of Judges is an illustration that the majority was always wrong because the majority of events that happened were wrong in terms of the law of God, the drift that the nation was allowed to get into, the moral decline, the doubt of authority, letting other ideas come in, calling tolerance what really is permissiveness, and there's quite a distinction. The book of Joshua and the book of Judges are two books that define the foundation of any nation and the character that nation will possess, the relationship with its neighbors and the people that live in the land. In this sense, these two books are probably the most important books of the prophets that were ever written. because they determine in general, broad outline, whether any nation will ultimately survive. There is reason to think that many of the areas where the Church of God is today in peace and safety is not, these areas will not be lands of peace and safety. Because our conduct, making mistakes internally, will lead to problems of an internal and sometimes external nature. Now, mostly in the book of Judges, we deal with the internal problem. I want to focus on that. The internal problem. What we permit and the consequences of what a nation permits. Now, when we move along to Samuel and Kings, we come to a period that is different. We come to a period in which the climax of mistakes were such that in the case of Samuel, who was a remarkable man in history without a question, his sons, of course, did not manage the office of the priesthood as they ought to. Now, the people could see the faults in Samuel's sons, but they couldn't see the faults in themselves. So they said, Samuel, your children do not walk after the example that you set. They didn't then say, Samuel, we want you to know we're going to be loyal to what you set as an example, irrespective of what your sons do. No, they decided to revolt. They said, we want a king like the other nations around us. Now, this can have reverse order because there may be, as in the history of Israel, a nation with a king, and the people will say, we want a republic. Samuel is a history, but Samuel is also a prophecy, because it indicates that the children of Israel are going to rebel against whatever constituted authority existed before. In that day, they had judges, and they rebelled and wanted a king. In the last millennium, we had kings, and the people have rebelled, as in France and the United States, and to a lesser degree, of course, in the British Commonwealth, certainly to an extent in Belgium. And you will find that this is typical, a decision to change the structure of government. It's happened in Rhodesia, it's happened in Ireland. Now, God does not look lightly on rebellion against a constituted form of government that exists. In that case, there was the government of God. Now, we grant that later in history, it was the government of men already. But there is, however, a way to look at the problem. It does not seem, when we read American history, that there was an appeal to the King of England in terms of his mercy, his reconsideration. But if you read what the Samuel Adams and what Samuel Adams and others did in this country, you will discover the hotheads that were in the Middle Atlantic states, New England. Now, God sometimes has an intention. He said to Samuel, he said, now, look, what the people are doing isn't good for them, they're rebelling. But in the end, I want you to let them have their wishes, because they need to know what it's like to have a king. Samuel protested, but they got their king anyway. They learned what it is like to have monarchical government. And the book of Samuel then becomes a prophecy of what is going to happen anywhere on earth, in Israel or not, when there are governments of this form. The consequences are laid out, so you know it is going to be oppressive, without any question. Not that every man acts that way, and there's some noblemen in history, but it's what happens the next generation. You look at the history of any country. And now, from another point of view, once we have constituted monarchy, as we did in England in the 18th century, we found that the colonies in the United States rebelled. And they decided they want a republic. In this case, we, the people, wanted a government formed after the Roman Empire in principle. Maybe I should correct that. That is the Roman Republic with aspects of the empire that might have helped clarify the state of affairs in the republic. Now, God revealed in Samuel the nature of the kingship and what would happen when men would seek their own government. And the story then of contrast between good government and bad. And any government that is ruled by God, as through David, will have the consequences of David's government. Any government ruled, as in the days of Saul, will have those consequences. These are broad perspectives. There are ups and downs in the history of Israel, and there are ups and downs in the history of any nation. But it shows what you can expect when this is the kind of government you have. So we realize that to a great extent, government is a major issue in the prophets. Now we come to the story, after we finish Samuel, that David is old, and we're now in 1 Kings. Now, in 1 Kings, we have the story of Solomon, and we have the story of luxurious government. And after we have luxurious government, we have a revolt. Now, we'll pick up the area where the revolt is. Essentially, we have chapter 12, and I won't go through the life of Solomon. You should be aware of it, that when people indulge, there are consequences. But I'm going to take a theme here for the moment. Beginning with chapter 12, we have a people who wanted to have their own form of government over their tribe. In this case, it was a very similar form, a kingship. But nevertheless, where a section revolts from a kingship. And that is where we clearly have our parallels with the United States in terms of Great Britain. We have today not a king ruling over us. We have a very great bureaucracy. And if you think that the King of England has power, you should see our bureaucracy. Because a republic that seeks to please the people must create more and more jobs at government level. So if the king takes your money, how much more will governments that have this bureaucratic structure in what we call the parliamentary form or republics as we have in the United States? It may vary from 20 to 25% to 40, 60, 80, 90. And in dear England, we have taxation for the very rich at 110%. That's going to take your savings. Or whatever the exact figure is that I know is over 100. Now, you know, not even King George could have gotten away with that. But every step people take that they claim is going to bring them liberty sooner or later produces an Achilles heel that will ultimately bring the destruction of the nation. Now, as I said, many of the stories recorded here in Judges pertain to internal events and internal consequences. When you come to Kings, first and second, as well as aspects of Samuel, there is an outward look to the historic events. The outward look is the relationship of the nation to other nations. Solomon, in a sense, is a prophet, not merely in what he wrote, but in what he did. He had deals with so many nations that he had to accept or wanted to accept wives from practically every prince and potentate around. He ended up with 700 because he had so many contracts to fulfill. Our nation today has its parallels in terms of all the obligations we have entered into around the world to defend the world. Now, the effect of this kind of relationship produced certain economic results that were remarkable and certain burdens that were serious. We have our parallels today. Now, sooner or later, we're going to find that the nations that had deals with Solomon, like the Arameans in Syria, the Egyptians, the Ammonites, the Moabites, and all of these, they're going to do just what you would expect. They're sooner or later going to turn against you. You can't be friends and expect throughout history that Greeks and Turks will always be your ally when they can't get along with each other. You can't expect Pakistan and India always to be allies of the United States, because in reality, they cannot get along with each other. And you can go down the line. This is why there could be no real agreement between Laos and Cambodia and South Vietnam. They may all, at one, two of them anyway, may have wanted our protection at one time or another, maybe three when you look at briefly Cambodia. But the fact is, they have always been at each other's throats anyway. And they would never remain our allies. And we're going to see the same thing throughout the rest of the world, and it's true of any nation. It just happens to be more true of us because we've had this power. All of Solomon's alliances never kept his kingdom together, because when he died, the other states turned against the nation, and Israel itself ended in civil war. These events are not telling us specific prophecies to the year. They're not telling us specific details. They are human experiences. They are cast in the form of a human experience, and they tell us to beware that when these things happen, these will be the consequences. They made alliances with Egypt. They made alliances with Assyria. They made alliances with Babylon. They had colonies of the Ammonites and Moabites and Edomites, and they revolted. And you could hardly blame them. But it's all there to read. Now, when a nation seeks to be colonial, it's the children of Israel who lorded it over. And you know, it is interesting. When Moses was there, God told Moses, do not touch the land of the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Edomites. He said, I've given that to those people for an inheritance. But I have promised Abraham the land of Canaan, and I warned the Canaanites, if they didn't change, that I would drive them out. And of course, they didn't change, but God gave them for centuries to think it over. Later on, the children of Israel lorded it over the Ammonites, Moabites, and Edomites, to whom the children of Israel were told in the days of Moses to let them alone. That was their inheritance. Now, of course, when we look at the book of Kings, it opens up and tells you what happens when you lord it over nations that God hasn't given you as inheritance. And Moab rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab. Chapter 1, verse 1. Do we think there was any way of holding on? Churchill had foresight in some ways and was utterly blind in others. He was not going to preside over the demise of the British Empire or Commonwealth. And look what happened when he did come back into power after a period of time following the Second World War. There's nothing he could have done to stop it. He did preside. One of the greatest men in this day couldn't hold together the empire, because it is not possible to try to put together that kind of structure and strip people of their political rights while you still give them education at Oxford and Cambridge, and teach them to be lawyers, and teach them matters of law, but don't give them a chance to practice it at the level they see it in the countries where they go to. There is no reason to think this couldn't have happened. Anybody could have foreseen it. Let me tell you, the same thing is ultimately going to happen to any empire. And if the Soviet Union is trying to build an empire, which it is, and though I do not think that every leader in China is a prophet, I do think that the present prime minister has more insight into what's going to happen in this generation than any American politician that I know of. The present Prime Minister of China said that the struggle between the Soviet Union and the United States is going to provoke or set the stage for a third world war. Now, we don't say that. In this country, we preach détente. And he said the primary cause of it will rest with the Soviet Union. And that's worth reading. I don't know if it'll appear in the Times or where, but this is a statement that has been made today at some official occasion in China. So when we go through the Book of Kings, we perceive now a broad picture of experience that should befall the nation of Israel or any nation that seeks to parallel the events that are here. You can't make the mistakes recorded here and not pay the penalty. Now, another aspect. The children of Israel instituted their own ideas about religion. And that's exactly what we basically have in the United States. We call it denominationalism in Christianity. The Gentiles often see it more clearly than we do. There is no way, of course, to resolve the problem because everybody now does what is right in his own eyes. Religiously and politically and, of course, economically. The consequences are, of course, that God punished the nation that did. A letter was shown me today, which John Hopkinson will answer for me. A person challenges the statement that we should do this or that, which we show in the Bible is what God asked his people then, as he would ask them today, to do. It's sort of a you can't show me approach. Or here's my idea. And that's what's natural to our society. There was no way to uproot the laws of Rehoboam. Now, they did go so far as not to allow certain things, like Baalism, to survive permanently in Israel. That was against the nature of the children of Israel, slaying the firstborn and roasting them in the fire, that kind of thing. But nevertheless, the fall of the house of Israel is fundamentally attributed to the fact that they made alliances with other nations and they broke the law of God. And yet we have people in the church today, and I'll tell it straight, we have people today who, if they could, would have the people in God's church do exactly what the children of Israel did in ancient times. To lay aside the holy days, to do what they please on the Sabbath, and to do what they please with practically anything else. If it pleases them to do what God said, fine, as long as they have the right to make the decision. This is just a reality. Now, most who had that idea left, but there are always people who are writing letters into headquarters showing they have the same idea and they're still in it. Or, that is, among it. We need to take a look at the Bible and see exactly how far some individuals went in that day and what, indeed, is in their mind today. But, you see, they have overlooked the fact that all these things were written for our admonition. But they don't read it for that kind of instruction. Now, when it's written for our admonition, in that sense, it has a prophetic significance. Because it means that the same, that the illustrations in that day producing consequences should help us foresee that the same practices today or similar ones, parallel ones, will have equal, and now with the bomb, more devastating consequences. The books of Joshua through 2 Kings are very interesting because, in a sense, they represent a prophetic view of the history of the children of Israel once they came to new lands and spread around the world in the last few centuries. And what is going to become of us as a nation? Whether we ever read Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel or the 12th, if we never had those prophecies, we could foretell on the basis of what happened to the children of Israel and Judah in the book of 2 Kings, that if we continue the way that the nation is now headed, as the nation then did, Israel and Judah, there is no way for us to avoid national destruction. Now, that would be a vague picture, and God didn't intend to leave it quite so vague. So he called, near the close of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, special prophets. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and others. We'll now look at the book of Isaiah. Now, we grant that there are many aspects of Isaiah that certainly seem to be prophetic. That is, they're looking into the future. There are parallels where symbolism is used. A vineyard is likened, the house of Israel is likened to a vineyard, and a special kind of vine is likened to Judah in chapter 5, verse 7. In other words, you have prophecies that are stated, a message from God to Isaiah for the people. Sometimes these messages seem directly referring to events of that day. Sometimes they were not, and probably in the former, the prophet was thought to either be realistic or a liar. In the latter, he's probably thought to be insane. Today, the higher critics look at these things and they say, well, now this one didn't happen as the prophet said, because they assume that the prophet was only speaking of his day. And I will be plain, I do not think that the prophets always knew of what day they were speaking. Because sometimes a prophecy is given without a specific time element, and part of it happened and part of it didn't, and they might have wondered why the rest failed. Now, an interesting method of study would be to analyze what did happen, what didn't yet happen, and we may discover that there are some specific things that have never happened that shall. But since it is also in the area of the prophet, even that which did happen must be seen also in a prophetic light. That is, what led up to that event, if repeated again, is likely to lead to a similar event, and there may even be an indication that the same people that provoked the problem then are going to provoke it today. That is, that we can say that some nations referred to in antiquity may indeed have descendants going by other names who have produced equal results in history. Now, I want to move along rapidly here because I think it is a general picture that we want to see. First of all, I want to turn to a section in the book of Isaiah that is a classic illustration of what we have already had. Now, we'll turn to the middle of the book of Isaiah. Chapter 36, to be specific. It came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And here, indeed, is a history. We've had prophecies. The Lord said to Isaiah, or you know, wherever he appeared, clear prophecies that are not history in the traditional sense as we've looked at it from Joshua through 2 Kings. But here we have, again, history in chapter 36, in chapter 37, in chapter 38, and in chapter 39. Look at them. There's Merodach-Baladan, the king of Babylon, whom we can date. There's the illness of Hezekiah, a past event. There was the siege of Jerusalem in the days of Hezekiah and Sennacherib, an Assyrian king. What is this doing in the midst of Isaiah? Well, all we know is that God put it here, or had Isaiah or those who organized the book following his death put it here. We know that Isaiah is a prophet. But he was writing also the national history. Extracts from that national history are given here because there are significant events. Here is an Assyrian king who besieges Jerusalem, whose army is smitten. Here is a king. A king is often the type of a nation that is sick. The nation is sick, the king was sick. The king sought God, and he was delivered. If the nation seeks God that is sick, the nation will be delivered. There was a king that came up Merodach-Baladan to see what God had wrought. Of course, Babylon later, about 150 years, 140, I should say, 130, did come up and take what was there in Judah. It produced a certain covetousness. There isn't any question. The nations are going to see our sickness. And they see what God has done to us despite our sickness. And it's going to provoke covetousness in them. But the significant part of this area is that it is basically referring to a time, if you look at what's gone before in Isaiah and what goes on after, it's referring to a time that is at the close of 6 millennia of human experience. It's referring to the time that begins with God's intervention by sending Jesus Christ. What happened with the destruction of the army of the king of Assyria? What's going to happen to an army that again will come to Jerusalem and surround it? Now, not every event will have its parallel. But after all, this is a history, and you're asked to deduce from it within the setting in which it occurs. You're asked to deduce from it whatever you can perceive. Now, some perceive nothing. They only see it as history. Some may perceive dimly, and some may perceive much more boldly the significance of events. It is left to you to examine it and the ministry to expound it. I think it is very significant that it is a king of Assyria who is doing this. Because, indeed, there are other prophecies in the book of Isaiah about a king of Assyria whom God will use as the rod of his anger. Now, when we discover there are prophecies like that, and there is no Assyrian empire in the Middle East anymore, there are a few people who were the mixed population in that empire who have lived and become Assyrian Christians, many of whom have come to the United States, and some who live in the great San Joaquin Valley. They're not the people. We're talking about a branch of that stock that is going to play the same kind of role in later history, as Isaiah would look at it, as the ancient Assyrians then were playing. A dominant nation among the Gentiles of the family of Shem. Now, there are a lot of things that are not said in the Bible. Many people who tend to give commentaries on the Bible will say that the Japhetic people live in Europe, they don't know what to do with the Asians, and the Semitic people live in the Middle East, and the Hamitic people live in North Africa, and they don't know what to do with the rest of Africa or the New World. But let them be in their darkness. The Japhetic people basically do not live in Europe, and the Shemitic people do. And in the family of Shem is a dominant nation that has, in fact, been the heart and core of the history of Europe for 1,000 years. The same as ancient Assyria played the role in the heart and core of Mesopotamia. For, if you please, about half of that time. History is much longer this time. There are people who don't know where the Assyrians disappeared to. And of course, there are people who don't know where the house of Israel disappeared to. And there are people who don't know where Christ disappeared to. And some of these people are in the church. At least for the former two ideas, I hope that none have any doubts about the latter. But based on their faith, they may think they know where he went, but somehow they haven't broken through the door yet to the Holy of Holies and contacted God the Father, or their attitudes wouldn't be what they are. Now, when we go to the book of Isaiah, we find many prophecies. Some of these clearly have never occurred. They're just events that are supposed to happen in the future. I will not take the time now, but I will simply explain that Isaiah is basically organized in a story flow. And if you want to take a look, a broad look, at the chapters as they move along, there may be a thread that carries you through to a certain point, and it goes back and takes you along the same area and goes a little further. And so you start in Isaiah where you don't end in Isaiah. And a way to understand it is to take a look at the early chapters to see that there is an introduction on the one hand, and then background, and then the book ends with some different theme altogether, the same as, of course, the Psalms does, the book of Psalms. When we come to some of these famous chapters like Isaiah 65, 66, it's quite clear we're not dealing here with something at the beginning of the millennium only. We're not dealing with something that goes back 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. When we deal with these events, we are often looking forward to the close of God's work on earth at the end and even after the millennium. Now, after we've had a general point of view in which we see God's promises about the glory that shall be God's, the reward of God's people, and the death of the wicked at the end of Isaiah, which has its parallels with Revelation, by the way. Now we note that God said he wanted another view of prophecy as a whole, and he said, let's try Jeremiah. Now, unlike Isaiah, who has very little history by comparison, Jeremiah has a lot of prophecies spoken in terms of the exact events of the time. Now, I don't care at this moment whether you think that Jeremiah wrote just after it happened and then he foisted it off on the people as a prophecy or not. I mean, there are critics who think that these men always wrote just after it happened. That's how they knew. Some of them think they were good newscasters. They understood it just before it happened. Well, fine. In many cases, Jeremiah was writing contemporary events because really, the issue is not how long it was between Jeremiah's prophecy and when they were fulfilled in his day. The issue is, what does Jeremiah's prophecy have to do with us? Because if it had to do only with that day, we have no reason to have it preserved in the Bible. A lot of things were recorded in that day that are not preserved because they're not relevant. What we need to do is go through the book of Jeremiah as it is organized, which is not always in chronological order. And we need to take a look at what the nation was doing and what the consequences would be. Now, whereas Isaiah takes a world view and addresses the nations much more often and addresses the church, people from all areas of the world, Jeremiah focuses in much more significantly on events in Judah. Suppose all of these events recorded in Jeremiah happened that are in the form of prophecy. Just let us suppose. That still means it's a prophecy for us because we can learn by what happened that similar consequences will produce similar results. We might find that there are some things that will not be repeated in terms of the name of the man. Nebuchadnezzar is dead. He isn't coming back to life until a resurrection. But there is a Babylon that anciently ruled Jeremiah, but you might say, well, maybe another power will do it. But then when you look at Revelation, you discover that the final power in this world that will bring its yoke on the children of Israel is also Babylon. Oh, now you understand that the reason God used Jeremiah as a prophet instead of a prophet in the days of the Arameans is the fact that the nation that is going to destroy God's people, his national people, is not going to be the Arameans living in Syria. Or he would have used a prophet when the Syrians were dominating. Rather, he used a prophet like Jeremiah when the Babylonians were dominating, because their system, and to no small extent, their people, are going to be a part of a system which will repeat the same thing. The conquest of this nation. Jeremiah did have some prophecies about the various nations around. some specific ones. And the interesting thing is that he often focuses on the nations in the Middle East, because indeed that's where, apparently, what we may not have fully seen before, oil is producing a tremendous arms race, so that we have a remarkable group of remarkable quantity of armaments in a group of nations that not only can ill afford to buy them, but can barely use them. They have to have training in this country. They are not yet equipped by experience. They don't have toys as we do that are mechanical and grow up with them. They have sheep and goats, like I do. When you live that way, you're not as aware. But nevertheless, they're acquiring all these armaments. The book of Jeremiah is in many cases historic, and in other cases strictly prophetic, in the sense it never happened before. But even if it did, even if there's a prophecy about Moab, about Egypt, about Babylon, about Ammon and Tyre and Sidon, what we need to do is examine it in terms of its meaning for us. When Isaiah talks about Tyre, he's talking about a system in the world. I think that's chapter 23, a very interesting chapter. When we come to Jeremiah, what we sometimes find are a whole series of events that may well have happened, and it's up to the historian who wants to study it to know whether it did. We're not necessarily concerned at this moment with all the details, but if I needed to go through every chapter in my responsibility, I would have to examine what we can historically to see if it did occur, and very likely many of the things have happened. For instance, the story of what happens here in this long chapter 48 of the book of Jeremiah about the land of Moab, and the punishments that came upon a number of areas, beginning with verse 21 through 24. Now, whether those happened, the cities themselves were once destroyed, I think we'd have to conclude that since they are archaeological heaps, that most likely it happened. Even though some critics might not want to agree with that in the atheistic world, in the agnostic world around us. But in any case, what we have is perhaps a direction of movement of an army from north to south or from east to west, and that's what you see. Now, the ancient sites are all gone. They're not inhabited today in many instances. But it is still a prophecy because there are other sites that have grown up around them. And what once happened to that nation because of its sins is going to happen to the new sites because the sins of the nations remain the same. That is, if they do. And an army is going to march through as surely the new cities as it marched through the ancient. Now, God chose to use this method of recording events, because in reality, he has left it to individuals to rename sites. He hasn't required them to. Only once in a while does he reveal a name in advance, like Cyrus, king of Persia, and Josiah. Those are the only two places in all the Bible that I know where a name is actually used in advance. But otherwise, names are not in that sense. Now, they may be the same city, or they may not be. But what you have is history in many cases that illustrates the kind of destruction that befell a nation, the direction. We often wonder, well, what happened to some of these Arabic tribes that might be mentioned in the book of Jeremiah, let's say, of Kedar and the kingdoms of Hazor, which Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, smote. Chapter 49, verse 28, just to pick out one. Well, what we learn is the family of Muhammad came from the tribe of Kedar. And so we recognize here the fact that there were ancient Arabic tribes that perished at the hand of the king of Babylon, and there are going to be some nations today that shall. Do not assume that every Arab nation is going to be treated with kid gloves by Europe, the heart and core of modern Babylon. There are going to be some nations that will be pressured to produce the oil for Europe. And the Arabs are concerned. You know why the Arabs are arming, of course, is because they are aware that their oil is meaningful to the great nations. And if they don't arm to protect their natural resources, those great nations are going to come in and take it. So we take note of the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel focuses in on events at Jerusalem primarily for many of the early chapters. It's mostly a day-by-day or a month-by-month or a year-by-year warning of what will happen to the nation. And it is cast in an unusual form. It is said that the message is pertaining to Jerusalem, and that day should be warnings to the house of Israel. And so there are people who are assuming that the house of Israel is not what we recognize and identify as the house of Israel at all. What happened to Jerusalem, the destruction of the nation, was a warning to what will happen to modern Israel as a whole. And I'm talking here not of the state of Israel specifically, but the house of Israel, which identifies the 10 tribes that were in the north. Ezekiel had a message for them. He was a prophet. I would say that as far as I know, probably most of the chapters up through 25 were warnings in that day. They become, therefore, since this is the form in which God proposed to convey a message, a warning to our nation today. That if we go the same way that ancient Judah did, we will be afflicted as the Jews were. And what will happen to our great cities? Destruction will come on them as destruction came on ancient Jerusalem. Jerusalem can defend itself with its walls. We can defend ourselves, we think, with our armament. And once in a while, Ezekiel, of course, tells us that the battle cry will go forth, but nobody is going to go to war, because in a volunteer army, who wants to die? Someday we're going to realize the catastrophe, though it may be an immediate benefit to us, the catastrophe of having this kind of protection. We move along to specific prophecies about specific nations. Some were fulfilled in the past. For instance, there are prophecies about what would happen to Egypt at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. The Nebuchadnezzar, of course, is the head of the Babylonian system as it started, and there's to be a final revival, so he's the type of the final man. And just as Nebuchadnezzar devastated Egypt, I wouldn't want to be living in Egypt on the basis of what the prophecy shows is going to happen to the country again. Because these things are going to happen in the day of the Lord, the latter day. And whether a part or a whole ever happened in the past is not the fundamental issue, because if a part did not and will happen in the future, we know it's prophecy, and a part of it did happen in the past, one, it happened, and it also is a warning. When it says here in chapter 30, for instance, I will make the multitude of Egypt to cease. Their population would be greatly diminished by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, chapter 30, verse 10. That means there's coming a time that there will be an invasion of Egypt by the European power that is Babylon or wherever it is centered, and I think that's the evidence. And they're going to devastate Egypt similarly. And if Nebuchadnezzar devastated ancient cities, the modern ones are going to be devastated equally. We'll move along. Ezekiel saw some things for the future in the last part of the book of Ezekiel that everybody admits was never really fulfilled. But let's just look briefly at the fact that when we come to the 12, the last section, we have prophecies pertaining to Israel, the house of Israel, the morality of ancient Israel, and then we have prophecies pertaining to the house of Judah. When we move through the story, Hosea, Joel, Amos, we should ask ourselves, why don't we have Amos, Joel, and Hosea? What you want to do is look overall and see what Hosea is telling us. What is his message? What is he emphasizing? And it's the background. It's basically historic with some prophecies interwoven. That is, that many of the things that were given in the prophecies may have happened in that day. And it illustrates basically what is going to happen to modern Ephraim as it happened to ancient Ephraim. That's the birthright tribe. And then we're given an insight in the book of Joel into the day of the Lord and the crisis immediately preceding it. And now when we come to the book of Amos, we take a look at many more specific details that anciently happened in the nation Israel and adjoining countries. So we ask what areas here might be repeated. There is little doubt that many of these prophecies in Amos pertain to that date. Some may have wholly been fulfilled, some only in part, or maybe some not at all. Those which were not then fulfilled, we should expect will. Those which have been may have parallels today in either the geographic area or with the same people involved. When you do come to Amos, you have a focus much more on the land of Palestine than you did with respect to Hosea, which was more a prophecy just about a people, Ephraim. And then you have a prophecy in Obadiah of a specific nation. You have a warning to the Gentiles, so to speak, in Jonah. And Jesus reaches into this book and even shows that an event that is certainly historic, about the time Jonah was in the belly of a fish, even had a significance, and he applied that specifically, or we would never have known that the reason it's 3 days and three nights is that that was going to be a sign about his own messiahship. But he reached in for that. We might not have known. Micah talks about the day of the Lord, much as Isaiah did. And then when we come to such books as Nahum, we have the final fall of the Assyrians. When we come to Habakkuk, we have the punishment that is going to come as a result of God raising up the Chaldeans, verse 6 of chapter 1. So you have the ancient Assyrians and Chaldeans mentioned, and therefore we assume there are modern Assyrians and Chaldeans, and we want to look for them. And then we have the specific prophecies pertaining to the final close of events in the Middle East, as in Zephaniah, aspects of Haggai that pertain to Zerubbabel and Joshua, the high priest. You may even have parallels with individuals here that may find repetition in the Church of God today. You come to the book of Zechariah and you're focusing in on the crisis at the close. It sort of ends with 70 years of punishment on the land in that day, just like it's focusing in on the end of time after our nation has been in a period of captivity when our land has to rest while we're in captivity. In other words, it's picking up the story right at the very close of history in the return of Christ. And then you have, of course, the return of Christ in the millennium, and there is a movement throughout those minor prophets. And then we come to the book of Malachi, which is, if you please, a warning to the church today, a warning to the nation. It's a warning to Israel. As it says, that's broadly speaking, all Israel. It doesn't say the house of Israel. It doesn't limit itself to excluding the house of Israel. We are Israel. We're Israel of the Spirit. And if the nation Israel is warned here, how much more should we who are Israel of the Spirit, that is, where the Spirit of God has come into us, take warning? There is a great emphasis on the fact of tithing, and when people get away from tithing, this is a final message, because indeed Malachi is addressing the people, interestingly, by introducing Elijah, as if Elijah is to come again. In other words, you have here the story of the law of Moses, my servant. And the book, of course, ends with the theme, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet." So here's a message about a specific individual. Now, ultimately, there's going to be the resurrection of Elijah, But in between, there was an Elijah in the days of John the Baptist, and there has to be an Elijah in this day, because it's talking about the day of the Lord. And one of the fundamental aspects of the message of Malachi is tithing, because the work of Elijah cannot be done without finances, and it's going to be done God's way. And yet there were people in the church who wanted to junk tithing 2 years ago, because they missed the message. They didn't see this was a prophecy. That in our day, this is the way in Israel God wants it done, and we're in Israel. Now, there's a lot more I didn't cover. This has been an hour and a half. You have plenty of reading to do. You have a number of Sabbaths ahead of you. Hopefully, you'll have the rest of your life to go through it. But I think it's time we got back to realize that there is a lot more to these prophecies, and we need to get the perspective. We can get so close to specific names and specific events and roads that ancient kings took that we have lost our way through the prophecies. And what we need to do is examine the broad perspective, then examine the major two sections, the former and latter, then examine each book, and then examine each chapter, and then examine each prophecy. But you don't start from the last, you start from the first, and you get the perspective. And then we begin to have some more understanding, and Mr. Armstrong's co-worker letter won't seem like a bolt out of the blue. Well, I was at dinner last night with a professor at UCLA who said to me practically the same thing, because he has family in Italy. And Mr. Armstrong said in the co-worker letter that I think came last Sabbath or this last weekend, that there was a crisis. And there are people in the world who know more about what's going on than some of us do. And you better listen. And if you don't care to listen to us, let me tell you, you better listen to the Prime Minister of China if you don't want to believe us. Because he said a third world war is coming, that there is no way to end it until the United States and Russia cease to be doing what they are doing, and the Russians are not going to cease, and therefore we can't.